Welcome to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak. Well, in the week since we were last together, Governor Romney has gotten a frightening bounce from his new persona of being a nice, caring guy who really wants to take care of the poor, the ill, and the elderly. This is, of course, not at all what the policies are he's been campaigning on for months. And he really is going to lower taxes for the wealthy. For example, he said he's going to eliminate all tax on dividends and long-term capital gains for people earning up to $200,000 a year. That's not the poor. They'll pay zero tax. So how many social programs, which he and Ryan are so disdainful of, is that lost government revenue going to come out of? And also, what Romney promised in the first debate was that he wouldn't lower the share of taxes that the rich pay. That's because he has said he'll lower every bracket by, 20%, while vastly increasing the military spending. So, simple math, as Paul Ryan likes to say, tells all voters that putting Romney and Ryan in charge would very quickly amount to huge cuts in education, infrastructure repair, safety net programs for the poor, public health, and environmental protection and restoration. I realize I'm talking to a progressive audience, but please try to talk to your undecided friends if you live in those swing states or can call them up. They're so closely divided: Ohio, Wisconsin, Iowa, Colorado, Virginia, Florida. Try using Thomas Frank's useful terms. This election is a choice between the maintenance crew or the wrecking crew. Remember, Romney has said also he, quote, doesn't see the point of public lands, unquote. We're a very long, long way from Teddy Roosevelt Republicans here. In just 4 years, they could sell off the people's property and shut down countless programs that have furthered the public good and made upward mobility possible. Well, various guests in recent weeks have mentioned on this program the call by Bill Moyers and others for a news story to compete with the Republican, you're totally free to be totally on your own story, that's been presented as the American framing story since the Reagan administration. I believe that a new framing story will need to emerge from many different sources, and it will need to be woven of various concepts and perspectives and terms. And as I've said before, I think the term the opportunity society is a good one. It seems to be accepted by just about every political persuasion. But an opportunity society surely requires accessible health care and good public education from kindergarten through grad school. Because of that, we cannot have an opportunity society unless we have a fair share society in which every person, corporation, pays in via taxes a proportional fair share of his or her income, or its corporate income, so that we can actually have an opportunity society. But those are social issues, and a new story that's up to the task today will have to embed them in an eco-social analysis and vision. The health of the ecosystems is the foundation of all else. A new story in 2012 must put this long-denied fact of life at the center. Toward that end, I'd like to read you a little bit of a text of a talk that Wendell Berry gave last May at the Future of Food Conference, which was sponsored by Washington Post Live and held at Georgetown University. This talk is published in the current issue of Resurgence magazine. The title is A New Agenda by Wendell Berry. Our fundamental problem is world destruction, caused by an irreconcilable contradiction between the natural world and the engineered world of industrialism. Today, the creaturely world is absolutely at the mercy of industrial processes, which are doing massive ecological damage. How much of this damage may be reparable by combined economic and cultural changes remains to be seen. Industrial destructiveness, anyhow, is our disease. Most of our popular worries, climate change, fossil fuel addiction, pollution, poverty, hunger, and legitimated violence, are its symptoms. If, for example, we were somehow granted a limitless supply of cheap, clean energy, we would continue and probably even accelerate our destruction of the world by agricultural erosion, chemical poisoning, industrial war, industrial recreation, and various forms of so-called development. And there's no use saying that if we can invent the nuclear bomb and fly to the moon, then of course we can solve hunger and related problems of land use. Epic feats of engineering require only a few brilliant technicians and a lot of money. But feeding a world of people year after year for a long time requires cultures of husbandry fitted to the nature of millions of unique small places, precisely the kind of cultures that industrialism has purposely disvalued, uprooted, and destroyed. Hard as it may be for a dislocated, miseducated, consumptive society to accept, and then it's in parenthesis, and for its pet economists to believe, close parenthesis, the future of food is not distinguishable from the future of the land, which is indistinguishable in turn from the future of human care. It depends ultimately on the health not of the financial system, but of the ecosphere. In the interest of that health, we will have to bring all the disciplines, all the arts and sciences, into conformity with the nature of places. My guest today is someone who has given a lot of insightful thought to the centrality of nature, to the only way forward that's going to actually work for the human species with regard to the current crises. Nina Simons is the co-executive director and co-founder of Bioneers, an organization that describes itself as a knowledge forum where social and scientific innovators illuminate breakthrough solutions for restoring people and planet. As a network of networks, Bioneers connects people with solutions and each other in an inspiring celebration of the applied genius of nature and human ingenuity. Okay. Nina Simons is a social entrepreneur who previously served as president of Seeds of Change and as director of strategic marketing for Odwalla. She directs Bioneers' Moonrise program, as well as her other hat she wears there, which is a whole systems approach to women's leadership, which includes cultivating women's leadership intensives for women leaders of diverse backgrounds, ages, and ethnicities. She's the editor of an anthology, Moonrise, The Power of Women Leading from the Heart, which was co-edited by Aniki Campbell, and it's used in a range of college classes now. She's received a Robert Rodale Award, the Rainforest Action Network REVEL Award, that's an acronym, R-E-V-E-L, and the Green Cross Millennium Award for Community Environmental Leadership. Last February, she was selected by Technica as one of the top 10 women of sustainability. I met Nina Simons once when we were both on a panel in 2004 at a national conference of an organization that was focused broadly on spirituality and psychology, but also interested in various engaged issues. Well, Bokhara Le Genre decided that what that particular organization needed was a women's panel. So she organized one and invited us. We all presented, and we had a very good time. But later I learned that that entire 20-year-old organization disbanded after that conference. So, gee, I hope it wasn't our women's panel. Oh, well. Nina Simons, welcome to All Together Now.
Thanks so much, Charlene. It's great to join you. I really loved your preamble.
Oh, thank you.
And I feel like you and I have been working and seeing on parallel tracks for a long, long time.
Yeah, I think that's true. And so much of the work you do at Bioneers is relevant, as you say, to this program's focus on what I call the relational shift, which is this growing awareness of the dynamic interrelatedness by which the whole physical world, including humans, is structured and functions. And there have been so many discoveries just in the last 5 years of what I call relational physiology. I mean, we're just starting to grasp how we really function. We're so profoundly interrelated with nature and other people, and it affects our physicality, the state of our physicality. And that's been missed by the whole biomechanical medical system, of course. So, we'll get into the upcoming Bioneers conference in a little bit, but first I'd like to ask you about your concept of relational intelligence. Love it. I came across a text of a talk you'd given back in 2005 in which you used that term. And when I happened to come across this text, I was in the very last stages of writing my book, Relational Reality. So I was able to slip in a mention of your coining that term, and I'm looking forward today to hearing more about it. And more recently, you've written, quote, "We have an abundance of relational intelligence to learn from. If only we can humbly accept its tutelage. The natural world is resplendent with symbiotic, long-term, reciprocal relationship between blossom and pollinator, moisture and mycelium, plants and herbivores. In nature, no one lives in isolation, and the sense of balanced interdependence is palpable in any thriving ecosystem. We can opt to be mentored by its mastery if we can quiet ourselves long enough to hear, smell, feel, and learn from it. I believe our survival, as well as our joy, may depend on our making this shift, bringing a practice of relational learning to the center of our attention." Well, terrific. I could not agree more. So let's start by you're telling us about your work with relational intelligence, particularly as applied to this reinvention of leadership.
Oh, gosh, Charlene. Well, it's a pleasure to talk about it with you. As I said, your work has really influenced me profoundly as well. You know, my sense is that I have been I've had the benefit of 23 years of Bioneers as my graduate school, really. And it's afforded me an opportunity to really learn from extraordinary leaders in every discipline, as well as every generation and every ethnicity and background. And it's kind of embedded within me a deeply systemic perspective, and one that says, you know, if it's not interdisciplinary and multicultural and multigenerational, I don't really want to play. Mm-hmm. What I have come to understand that I mean when I talk about relational intelligence is really there are several ideas sort of inherent in it. One of my guiding principles very early on was a quote that I heard Fritjof Capra say, where he said, "The shift to an eco-literate society involves a shift from counting things to a shift on to shifting our focus toward mapping relationship."
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, that's so interesting, because of course it describes a shift from a culture that quantifies to a culture that qualifies.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not only a shift from things to relationship, but a process shift in how you approach what you measure and what you value, that's so deep that it's hard to even begin to really see how insidiously the bias toward quantification is embedded in our culture.
That's right.
Even to our languages, yeah. Because the Indo-European languages are what the linguists call nominalized. They're about the nouns, but emphasis on the nouns, the naming of things, the categorizing of things. There's not attention to subtle process and subtle changes and dynamic interrelatedness that there is in a lot of native peoples, cultures, and also Eastern philosophy.
Exactly. And then the other piece that you may relate to is that as I've been on a journey of inquiry around gender justice and what it means to be a female in a society that does have a bias toward, not only towards men in leadership particularly, but towards those human qualities that we associate with the masculine.
Right.
And so I've, as a communicator, I've been sort of delicately stepping my way through this minefield, trying to understand how I can best articulate the changes that I see afoot and that need to happen more quickly and more widely in ways that don't trigger people's defensiveness or, you know, an immediate not me reaction. So, for example, you know, we all know that if you use the word patriarchy, pretty much half the people will shut down.
Right.
It's a pretty good bet. And while many women may understand what we're talking about, some may not. And what I've found is that part of what has characterized the culture that I believe is dying and that characterizes this new culture that we're all struggling to midwife into emergence is a shift from focusing on leading from the intellect only or principally to leading our actions, our plans, our strategies really based on what I call our relational intelligence. And I consider the relational intelligence to be more than our hearts or our emotions.
Right.
I consider the relational intelligence to really include that physical intelligence that you referred to, that's the product of billions of years of evolution that lives in our bodies,
mm-hmm.
as well as our intuitive or spiritual or dreamtime awareness,
mm-hmm.
which also is a tremendous source of information that our culture has tended to devalue.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, what I really mean when I talk about relational intelligence implies a shift from being totally intellect-focused or primarily intellect-focused to really integrating the intelligence of those three other ways of our being, which I do think is a more inherently feminine way to be.
Yeah, I guess I'd add to that the findings about gender-based patterns of perception, which I think would go in the intellect corner and it definitely separates the boys from the girls. They usually use college students, that's why I use that term. But starting in 1953, psychologists have given, hundreds if not thousands of iterations in many countries of this original experiment in perception where they would show a design, a pattern that had foreground figures and then they were set in a pattern surrounding it. And almost always, the vast majority of the male participants would focus on the foreground figures and the vast majority of the female participants would see the total pattern. They would see the gestalt. That's a skill that's badly needed in this society, especially because of my book, Relational Reality, and all the other indicators bringing together these discoveries that, guess what? Reality is so relational. It's not the way we were taught in school. It's not that everything is a discrete aggregate and separate and maybe it's in some kind of relationship with what's next to it. No. The way we're structured is relational. The way we function is interrelated. So at the time they first did these experiments in 1953, the male psychologists put a patriarchal spin, if I may say, on the results and said, let's give a positive adjective to the male students. And they would say that the males were field independent, but the females were field dependent. And then all these articles came out of that through the 50s and 60s that men, that women can't reason clearly. They're not clear thinkers who can focus right away on those foreground figures separated out from the surroundings. And therefore, they're easily influenced by people. They're rather childlike in their thinking. And it said they're even more like what they were calling then primitive cultures. In other words, the indigenous perception of the Gestalt was like these modern 1950s female students seeing the Gestalt. Well, I'm fine with that. Anyway, my point is, you know, that's right in there with the way the brain works. And I think it's important now, there's still so much debate going on about male-female brain differences. Mm-hmm. And lately, you know, these a couple of books saying, oh, the end of men, women are pulling ahead in the economy. And then there have been two long articles in New York Times and somewhere else I saw by sociologists saying, no, they're not. That's a very skewed way of looking at the statistics in just particular, you know, cities or economic groups or fields. So it's basically business as usual. And in order to correct that, they've said at the end of these articles, there isn't any difference between male and female brains, you know. So, I mean, it's clearly wrong to make a statement at either end of that spectrum. There's nothing but difference between male and female, or there are no differences between male and female. Well, there really are. Yeah. And one of them that, as I say, is so well established is that women tend to see the gestalt of a situation. And I would just say that this skill is so badly needed in our culture now. So, you know,
well,
I would put that in your category of intellectual patterns.
No, I completely agree, Charlene, and it's a really interesting story. And I think what I would add to it is that clearly women are making a lot of advances, and the idea of the oversimplification that women are now leading in academia and economy and, you know, women are taking the lead and we're at the end of men is absurd. We are, I would say, in a giant reinvention of what gender roles mean. And I think that there is tremendous nuance and variation that you need to acknowledge right up front, of course, because there are women who are perpetuating a patriarchal model worse than many men. And similarly, there are men who are leading relationally in brilliant and innovative ways. In fact, for me, it's one of my great accomplishments of the Moonrise book is that it includes stories of men. But I think I would add also to your stories about
I think especially ecological men are relational thinkers. So,
well, yes.
A lot of green men,
And while the you know, the data on science on brain differences is very disputable, there are a couple of studies that I really love that sort of describe the kind of relational intelligence that I see us having. And actually, before I go there, I just wanted to cite one other thing, which was with respect to the pattern recognition that you describe in those studies that women tend to have, it makes sense if you consider our evolution over billions of years, with men evolving as hunters and women evolving as gatherers, that we would develop a capacity for pattern recognition. Right? I mean, if you're trying to describe and articulate to another woman where a particular plant is and what it looks like, you've got to be able to describe the field it's in. And, you know, there's a whole pattern that actually emerges in order to locate it. But the other thing that I love that describes some gender differences is one of them was a study that was done with very young toddlers, like 2 or 3 year olds. And what they found, and it intrigues me because at 2 or 3, you have to imagine, you know, kids haven't had that much chance for socialization. And when they put boy children and girl children behind a wall that separated them from their mothers, they had very distinct reactions. And the boys tried to climb over the wall. They tried to batter it down. They threw their bodies against it.
Hmm.
They basically responded by trying to bring force to changing the situation. And the girls, on the other hand, typically cried for their mothers.
Hmm.
That was their response, was like loss of connection. I'm
mm-hmm.
going to ask for connection, and they got picked up. The other one that I love is a study that was done that's not about brain science so much as it is about hormones, but it's really about, describes the difference between how men and women typically respond to stress. And I'm sure you know this study. It's from the early 90s in UCLA, and it was
mm-hmm.
came to be called the Tend and Befriend Study.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they studied men and women in an office environment. And, you know, I find it particularly relevant to now, because if there's one thing that's true about now, it's that the stress levels we're all experiencing are going up and up and up.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they found was that the men in the office environment, when they felt stress, tended to respond in either a fight or flight reaction.
Mm-hmm.
They tended to either become aggressive or to go into their offices and withdraw and close the door and isolate themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And the women, on the other hand, tended to gather around the water cooler and tell each other stories and talk
mm-hmm.
about what was stressing them out.
Mm-hmm.
And what they found, of course, was that when women connect, we release oxytocin in our bodies, which actually helps our bodies biologically recalibrate our nervous systems to reach equilibrium. And
right.
So, you know, it was just very interesting that, again, we tend to reach out.
I remember when that study came out, then the researcher said, so this puts a different light on people looking down at, oh, women talking on the phone all the time to each other.
Right.
You know, they're really
yeah.
taking care of their health and well-being.
Well, exactly. And I think, you know, I think it's really important to note that at this point, as scientists are increasingly studying what makes a system resilient, what makes it able to rebound to functionality after trauma, it's social ties, it's social mm-hmm. connections.
Right.
That's among the primary criteria.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We're going to have to take a break in a couple minutes and move into, I want to hear a little bit more about this, the program for leadership and then the Bioneers Conference. But before we break, I just want to share with the listeners something relevant to this discussion, and that's what I was told by a professor in Germany when I conducted 62 interviews in the summer of, 1983 of the German Green Party. And one of the people in Parliament was Professor Erika Hickel, and she had been a professor of the history of pharmacology for many decades at a technical university, Braunschweig Technical University, so it was largely a male faculty. And she had arrived at what I call the Erika Hickel rule, and that was that women do have this different kind of perception, and men just blow it off. It doesn't make sense to them. It's not the way they see those foreground figures instead of the gestalt, which leads to a lot of problems not being solved and solutions being poorly framed if you don't see the gestalt. But anyway, so the rule she arrived at over all these years was that if a committee or a working group wasn't at least one-third women, she wasn't going to go into it because her whole way of seeing could not be heard.
Yep.
And that's something women are familiar with. So she even stayed up late into the night of the voting because she saw that she, in her region, was at the top of the list for the Green Party, and she was going to become a parliamentarian and go to the Bundestag, a great honor. But she stayed up watching all the returns from the rest of the country and calculating what the male-female proportion would be in the Green Party Fraktion, as they call it, the group of. And if it wasn't going to be one-third women, she was not going to go into Parliament.
Yeah.
So that's how strongly she felt about it, and I passed that along. For them what's listening. Okay, we need to take a break right now. This is Charlene Spretnak speaking with my guest Nina Simons on All Together Now.
Let's give them something to talk about, babe.
Welcome back to All Together Now.
This is Charlene Spretnak speaking with my guest, Nina Simons, the co-founder and co-executive director of Bioneers, an organization that has a great website, by the way, bioneers.org. So before we move into this upcoming annual Bioneers Conference and these networks of regional Bioneers conferences all over the country, this Moonrise program for women's leadership, is that something people can find out about by looking at the bioneers.org website?
Yeah, they sure can, Charlene. It's a program that really we've been developing over the last several years, and it has four different parts, one part of which is really embedded within the Bioneers Conference, and then we take media and communications that really advance this full-spectrum leadership model and spread them much more widely, and also do these deep six-day intensive women's leadership trainings, which are tremendously exciting and transformative and seem to be filling a niche within the women's leadership movement that I don't see being filled elsewhere.
Uh-huh. And that goes on during the year, apart from the conference, is that right?
Yes, it's quite apart from the conference, and we produce anywhere from two or three of them per year, and we encourage women to apply for them because we actually select a cohort of 20 women for each one, and we select each cohort with two main criteria, really, to identify women who are deeply committed to some sort of environmental or social change in their communities, and also really have the connections and the capacity to affect change in those communities.
Mm-hmm.
And we also select to optimize difference among the cohort. So with each group of 20 women, typically there are women there in their early 20s going up to their late 70s or early 80s, and there are women of all backgrounds, of all disciplines, and actually in alignment with that German story you were just telling, we have a minimum of 30% women of color at every training, and most
uh-huh.
recently there have been 40 to 50% women of color. So, and we co-teach them in collaboration with a woman of color facilitator. So it's a very exciting experiential journey into not only clarifying each woman's sense of purpose or unique assignment, but also really practicing skills and practices that increase our capacity to connect across difference.
Mm-hmm.
Because we really are based on the assumption that connecting across difference is one of the most valuable leadership skills we could all be cultivating in ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's also really a place where we have an opportunity to look at what are women uniquely bringing to the reinvention of leadership at this time. Because what I found in my own personal journey, Charlene, was that when I started being acknowledged for my leadership, mm-hmm. I had a very conflicted response.
Mm-hmm.
Some part of me was flattered, and another part of me felt like, oh, don't put that label on me.
Yeah.
And I began to realize that without ever being conscious of it, I had adopted a kind of culturally inherited definition of what leadership looked like. And I saw it as being hierarchical and mm-hmm. top-down and self-sacrificial and solitary mm-hmm. and a lot of things that I didn't really aspire to. And, you know, what I realized as I unpacked it, and also in the course of selecting stories for the Moonrise book, was that we have many, many examples around and among us of leadership that's very different than that, and that we're all collectively redefining leadership right now, and that if we can do that in a conscious way, it gives us an opportunity to really wholeheartedly accept and embrace that assignment.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, the other piece of this is when in our lives do we get an opportunity to spend 6 days with a group of 20 peer women who are smart and engaged and purposeful and effective leaders, but who are really from every different sector and discipline of our typically factionalized culture.
Right.
Right? And really go in deep together and see what it feels like to have a group of, you know, 20 women authentically aligned and at each other's backs.
Right.
And I think we have many examples of negative examples of how women can be with each other more than we have experienced embodied reference points for how women can really dramatically and quickly strengthen and accelerate each other's leadership development.
Oh, that sounds hugely important. Yeah.
Well, it's tremendously exciting, and I love it. And part of what I've found in the course of doing it, we're now really developing. We have about 250 women who've done the program, and we're really working to develop that into a network, because what I found is that there are extraordinary women in leadership, not only at the grassroots level, but also in leadership roles in major organizations and in businesses. And to be able to create a network for those women to be able to connect with each other, having this shared vocabulary and experiential reference point, mm-hmm. Will be a meaningful ongoing source of support to everyone.
Mm-hmm. Great. Okay, we have about 8 minutes left. Let's have you explain the overall goal of what the Bioneers Conference is every year. I guess this is the 23rd annual conference.
Yes.
And I read this wonderful phrase on the website that at the center of this framing, the perspective of the conference is dynamic interrelatedness and reframing the environment as the mother of all issues, not only conceptually but experientially as well.
Well, it's true, and I think that that phrase is one of the things that has kept me deeply involved and invested in Bioneers for all these years,
mm-hmm.
because I think I'm an unusual environmentalist in that I came to this work through the arts. I
uh-huh.
didn't like science in school,
uh-huh.
but I've always had a direct personal experience of the natural world as being a source of sanctuary and learning for me.
Right.
And so it was that kind of personal love of nature that really brought me to it. And what I found was that really at the heart of Bioneers, Charlene, is the recognition that throughout our culture and the mainstream media, typically there's a great deal of focus put on the problems, but very little attention and coverage of the plethora of solutions that are emerging.
Right. Right.
And so, you know, when we initially started Bioneers in 1990, it was partly prompted by a sense of concern around both climate change and the loss of biodiversity and species extinction.
Mm-hmm.
But it was also always designed to have this very strong human component that was not only about social justice, but how do we learn to relate to ourselves and each other in ways that can then encourage us to relate to nature differently?
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the ways that I see what we're facing with respect to the crises, the multiple crises that we face, is that really they can be described as a crisis of relationship.
Mm-hmm.
It's a, you know, a crisis of relationship within ourselves, with each other, and with the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And really what we need to do is come back into relationship with the world we've made and the world that's made us.
Mm-hmm.
And that if we can align those two worlds, then we have a hope of moving through this with least harm.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so Bioneers has always been about, it's sometimes I think of it as a kind of environmental and social star search, where we look for people, some known and some unknown, who've really developed breakthrough solutions for many of our most pressing environmental and social challenges, and bring them together in an effort to shine a light on what's possible, because together I believe that they illustrate the world that's possible now.
Mm-hmm.
And what folks seem to experience time and time again is, for one thing, that they're not alone, for a second thing, that there's an enormous infusion of hope and grounded optimism that seems to come from the conference, and also that with the recognition that all these solutions are currently available and possible, we all have to confront the fact that it's really our engaged action and the political will that's needed to move them forward.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the big surprises after we started Bioneers was that we assumed that people would know each other. We assumed that when we brought together people working on river restoration and oceans, that they would be colleagues and they would be exchanging information. And in fact, what we found was that all the disciplines were so segmented that bringing people together across discipline to share best practices and learning and, you know, solutions was as powerful as getting their information out there to the world. So it's a
It's well known for, you know, showing people what's already working on the ground level, new ideas that are have been put into place you might not know about and are proven to work. So it's very exciting when you bring it all together. I just want to say to people, it's not this coming weekend, but it starts a week from tomorrow. It's the 19th to 21st of October in San Rafael, California, at the Marin Center. And there are also regional conferences, some of them with satellite hookups and live streaming of the presentations at the big conference. Is that right?
That's true. There are 22 communities around the country that are having regional conferences as well. And it's worth letting folks know that in case you've ever heard of it or had a hankering to come but had money get in the way, we currently have 2-for-1 registration passes and half-day access. And in addition to the website that you mentioned, Charlene, there's one that's just about the conference. That's conference.bioneersgroup.com.
conference.bioneersgroup.com.
Right. And one of the things that's neat about that site is that you can look on it and see we've divided, you know, when we program Bioneers, we actually program it for 12 different areas, 12 different constituencies, if you will. And so that includes things like, in addition to land restoration and conservation, things that you might, or green building, things that you might expect at an environmental conference, there's also the new economy, you know, or economics, as we call it, or women's leadership, or justice, and racial, you know, including racial justice, gender justice, resilient communities, there and education. So there are all these different fields that really we've divided up the conference program on that website so that you can look at it by tracks. And you can actually see what does the women's track look like.
And that's where people could also find if they're near a regional one?
Yes, I think you can find the Beaming Bioneers satellite sites on either that one or the Bioneers.org site.
Okay, you want to put in the search box Beaming Bioneers, right?
Right, right.
Okay, we have a minute left. This is just like the last time we had a public conversation in 2005. This has been so much fun, and it's gone so fast.
I know.
In the minutes that's left, you want to just talk about, there are a couple of these workshops, pre- and post-conference.
Absolutely.
One of them's Feminomics, and one of them's on the beloved community.
Yeah, why don't I give a quick snapshot of each?
Okay, so, very quickly, yeah.
Okay, Feminomics is the day after the conference, and really while many people are looking at how we reinvent economics, nobody's taken a gender lens specifically to that question. So we're really looking at how women's leadership and a gender lens and natural systems are reinventing economics that work for all, and it's going to be a fantastic day. And the day before the conference, we're doing something called Catalyzing a Resilient Communities Network, which is recognizing that just as in nature, networks are the primary organizational structures through which things change. And what we realized is there are many different groups, transition towns, slow food, slow money, Bali, that are working on localizing networks. But nobody's brought them all together to see what happens.
Okay.
So that's what that's about.
That is one of the ones that caught my eye, catalyzing a resilient communities network. Well, thank you so much, Nina Simons, for coming on the program.
It's my great pleasure, Charlene. Thank you for having me.
Okay, let's take a walk over to the Arts Corner now. Our poem for this week, well, it's a fittingly relational poem by Liesl Mueller. She's published 11 volumes of poetry and was awarded the Pulitzer Prize in 1997 for her collection entitled Alive Together. Earlier, she won the National Book Award in 1980 for a collection entitled The Need to Hold Still. As Liesl Neumann, she came with her family from Germany to the United States when she was 15 years old in 1939. She's now 88 years old and lives in a retirement community in Chicago. This poem is Animals Are Entering Our Lives by Liesl Mueller. And she begins it with an epigraph here at the top. Quote, I will take care of you, unquote, the girl said to her brother, who had been turned into a deer. She put her golden garter around his neck and made him a bed of leaves and moss. And underneath it, it says, from an old tale. Enchanted as what they is what they were in the old stories, or if not that, they were guides and rescuers of the lost, the lonely, needy young men and women in the forest we call the world. That was back in a time when we all had a common language. Then something happened. Then the earth became a place to trample and plunder. Betrayed, they fled to the tallest trees, the deepest burrows. The common language became extinct. All we heard from them were shrieks and growls and wails and whistles, nothing we could understand. Now they are coming back to us, the latest homeless driven by hunger. I read that in parks of Hong Kong, the squatter monkeys have learned to open soft drink bottles and pop-top cans. One monkey climbed an apartment building and entered a third-floor bedroom. He hovered over the baby's crib like a curious older brother. Here in Illinois, the gulls swarm over the parking lots miles from the inland sea, and the Canada geese grow fat on greasy leftover lunches in the fastidious landscaped ponds of suburban corporations. Their seasonal clocks have stopped. They summer, they winter. Rarer now is the long, black, elegant V in the emptying sky. It still touches us, though we do not remember why. But it's the silent deer who come and eat each night from our garden, as if they had been invited. They pick the tomatoes and tender beans, the succulent daylily blossoms and dewy geranium heads. When you labored all spring planting our food and flowers, you did not expect to feed an advancing population of the displaced. They come like refugees everywhere, defying guns and fences and risking death on the road to reach us, their dispossessors, who have become their last chance. Shall we accept them again? Shall we fit them with precious collars? They scatter their tracks around the house, closer and closer to the door, like stray dogs circling their chosen home. Our song today, well, we're going to hear another one of the great Ohio altos. We've already heard Tracy Chapman, who's from Cleveland, and we'll definitely be hearing more from her. For today, though, it's Chrissy Hind, who's from Akron. And since we've been talking about topics related to community today, we'll hear a song about what happens when suburban sprawl paves over beautiful land and the charming parts of an old city are destroyed. This is The Pretenders, featuring Chrissy Hind on vocals, singing, I went back to Ohio, but my city was gone. ¶¶
places. My city had been pulled down, reduced to parking spaces. Hey, oh, where to go, Ohio?
Chrissy Hynde and the rest of the Pretenders with My City Was Gone. And by the way, Ms. Hynde is apparently not the kind of gal to simply name the problem. No. To help with efforts to achieve community renewal and build up community-based local economy, she opened a vegan restaurant in Akron in 2007. Unfortunately, it was unable in the end to weather the economic crash the following year and the very slow recovery in northeastern Ohio, so the restaurant had to be closed last year. But thanks for trying, Chrissy. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. Join me next week when my guest will be Jerry Mander, talking about his new book, The Capitalism Papers. Till next time, this is Charlene Spretnak with All Together Now.